man brought Blot in to speak to Hal about something disturbing they encountered during their disciplinary shit detail in the tunnels that PM. Hal holds up a hand for the kids to hang on, flipping through cartridge cases to see whether low-temperature civics is up here. All the cases are clearly labeled. The apparition receded, the red of its coat shrinking against the swinging view of Prospect Street and pavement and dumpsters and looming storefronts. Ruth Van Cleve on its lurid tail and receding also, screaming bits of urban argot that became less faint than swallowed. Kate Gompert held her hurt head and heard it roar. Ruth Van Cleve's pursuit was slowed by her arms, which were waving around as she screamed, and the apparition was swinging their purses to clear a path on the sidewalk before it. Kate Gompert could see pedestrians leaping out into the street way up ahead to avoid getting clocked. The whole visual scene seemed tinged and violet. A voice under a storefront awning right nearby somewhere said, "Seen it." Kate Gompert leaned over again and held the part of her head that surrounded her eye. The eye was palpably swelling shut, and her whole vision was queerly violet. A sound in her head like a drawbridge being drawn up. Implacable trundle and squeaks. Hot, watery spit was flooding her mouth, and she kept swallowing against nausea.
"Seen it? Bet your ever-living goddamn life I seen it."
A kind of gargoyle seemed to detach itself from a storefront hardware display and moved in, its motions oddly jerky, as in a film missing frames.
"Seen the whole thing,"
it said, then repeated it.
"I'm a witness,"
it said. Kate Gompert put her other arm out against the light post and hauled herself mostly upright, looking at it.
"Witness the whole goddamn thing," it said.
In the eye, that wasn't swelling shut, the thing resolved violently into a bearded man in an army coat and a sleeveless army coat over that coat, spittle in his beard. One eye had a system of exploded arteries in it. He shook like an old machine. There was a smell involved. The old man got right up close, looming in, so that pedestrians had to curve out around both of them together. Kate Gompert could feel her pulse in her eye.
"Witness! Eyewitness! The whole thing!"
But he was looking someplace else, like more around at people passing.
"Seen it. I'm him."
Not clear who he was shouting at. It wasn't her. And the passers-by were paying that studious urban kind of no attention as they broke and melted around them at the light post and then reformed. Kate Gompert had the idea that supporting herself against the light post would keep her from throwing up. Concussion is really another word for a bruised brain. She tried not to think about it, that the impact had maybe sent one part of her brain slamming against her skull, and now that part was purply swelling, mashed up against the inside of her skull. The light post she held herself up with was what had hit her.
"Fellow, I'm your fellow. Witness, saw it all."
And the old fellow was holding a trembling palm up just under Kate Gompert's face, as if he wanted it thrown up into. The palm was violet, with splotches of some sort of possible fungal decay, and with dark branching lines where the pink palm lines of people who don't live in dumpsters usually are. And Kate Gompert studied the palm abstractly, and the weather-bleached gigabucks ticket on the pavement below it.
299.
The ticket seemed to recede into a violet mist and then move back up. Pedestrians barely glanced at them and then looked studiously elsewhere, a drunk-looking pale girl and a street bum showing her something in his hand.
"When is the whole thing being committed?"
the man remarked to a passerby with a cellular on his belt. Kate Gompert couldn't summon the juice to tell him to go screw. That's the way it was said down here in the real city. "Go screw," with a deft little thumb gesture. She couldn't even say go away, though the smell involved in the man made it worse, the nausea. It seemed terribly important not to vomit. She could feel her pulse in her eye the pole had hit. As if the strain of vomiting could aggravate the spongy purpling of the part of her brain the pole had bruised. The thought made her want to vomit in this horrid palm that wouldn't stay still. She tried to reason. If the man had witnessed the whole thing, then how could he think she'd have change to put in his hand? Ruth Van Cleve had been listing some of her baby's jailed father's wittier aliases when Kate Gompert had felt a hand strike her back and close around the strap of her purse. Ruth Van Cleve had cried out as the apparition of just about the most unattractive woman Kate Gompert had ever seen crashed forward between them, knocking them apart. Ruth Van Cleve's vinyl purse's strap gave right away, but Kate Gompert's thin but densely macrameed strap held around her shoulder, and she was pulled wrenchingly forward by the womanly apparition's momentum as it tried to sprint up Prospect Street. And the red hag-like figure was yanked wrenchingly back as the quality filings all-cotton, French braidedly macrameed purse strap held, and Kate Gompert had got a whiff of something danker than the dankest municipal sewage, and a glimpse of what looked like a 5-day facial growth on the hag's face, as street-tough Ruth Van Cleve got a grip on her, his, its red leather coat, proclaiming the thief a son of a muff-fun-ho. Kate Gompert was staggering forward, trying to get her arm out of the strap's loops. They all three moved forward together this way. The apparition spun itself violently around, trying to shake off Ruth Van Cleve, and her its spin with her purse took the strap-attached Kate Gompert, who didn't weigh very much, out, around, in a wide circle. She'd had a flashback of reminiscence back to Crack the Whip at the Wellesley Hills Skating Club's rinks, Wee Blades toddler skating hour as a child, gaining speed. And then a rust-pocked curbside lightpost rotated toward her, also gaining speed, and the sound was somewhere between a bonk and a clang, and the sky and the sidewalk switched places, and a violet sun exploded outward, and the whole street turned violet and swung like a clanging bell. And then she was alone and purseless, and watching the two recede, both seeming to be shrieking for help. The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. A disadvantage of your nasally ingested cocaine being that at a certain point, somewhere past the euphoric crest, if you haven't got the sense left to stop and just ride the crest and instead keep going nasally, it takes you into regions of almost interstellar cold and nasal numbness. Randy Lentz's sinuses were frozen against his skull, numb and hung with crystal frost. His legs felt like they ended at the knees. He was trailing two very small-sized Chinese women as they lugged enormous paper shopping bags east on Bishop Allen Drive under Central. His heart sounded like a shoe in the Ennett House basement's dryer. His heart was beating that loud. The Chinese women scuttled at an amazing rate, given their size and the bag's size. It was circa 22:12:30 to 22:12:40 hours, smack in the middle of the former interval of issues resolution. The Chinese women didn't walk so much as scuttle with a kind of insectile rapidity, and Lentz was heart-pressed to both keep up and seem to casually saunter, numb from the knee down and the nostril back. They made the turn onto Prospect Street, two or a few blocks below Central Square, moving in the direction of Inman Square. Lentz followed 10 or 30 paces behind, eyes on the twine handles of the shopping bags. The Chinese women were about the size of fire hydrants and moved like they had more than the normal amount of legs, conversing in their anxious and high-pitched monkey language. Evolution proved your orientoid tongues were closer to your primatal languages than not. At first, on the brick sidewalks of the stretch of Mass Ave between Harvard and Central, Lentz had thought they might be following him. He'd been followed a great deal in his time. And like the well-read Jeffrey D., he knew only too well, thank you, that the most fearsome surveillance got carried out by unlikely-looking people that followed you by walking in front of you with small mirrors in their glasses' temples, or elaborate systems of cellular communicators for reporting to the command center, or else also by helicopters, also, that flew too high to see, hovering, the tiny chop of their rotors disguised as your own drumming heart. But after he'd had success at successfully shaking the Chinese women twice, the second time so successfully he'd had to tear ass around through alleys and vault wooden fences to pick them up again a couple blocks north on Bishop Allen Drive, scuttling along, jabbering. He'd settled down in his conviction about who was trailing who here. As in, just who had the controlling discretion over the general situation right here. The ejection from the house, which the ejection had at first seemed like the kiss of a death sentence, had turned out to maybe be just the thing. He tried the straight-on narrow, and for his pains had been threatened and dismissively sent off. He'd given it his best, and for the most part, impressively. And he had been sent away, alone, and at least now could openly hide. R. Lentz lived by his wits out here, deeply disguised, on the anonymous streets of North Cambridge and Somerville, never sleeping, ever moving, hiding in bright lit and public plain sight, the last place they would think to find him. Lentz wore fluorescent yellow snow pants, the slightly shiny coat to a long-tailed tux, a sombrero with little wooden balls hanging off the brim, oversized tortoiseshell glasses that darkened automatically in response to bright light, and a glossy black mustache promoted from the upper lip of a mannequin at Leechmere's in Cambridgeside. The ensemble, the result of bold snatch and sprints all up and down the nighttime Charles, when he'd first gone overground northeast from Enfield several odd days back. The absolute blackness of the mannequin's mustache, very securely attached with promoted crazy glue and made even glossier by the discharge from a nose Lentz can't feel running, gives his pallor an almost ghostly aspect in the sombrero's portable shade. Another both advantage and disadvantage of nasal cocaine is that eating becomes ociose and optional, and one forgets to, for extended periods of time, to eat. In his gaudy pastiche of disguise, he passes easily for one of Metro Boston's homeless and wandering mad, the walking dead and dying, and is given a wide berth by all comers. The trick, he's found, is to not sleep or eat, to stay up and moving at all times, alert in all six directions at all times, heading for under the cover of T station or enclosed mall whenever the invisible rotor's cardiac chop betrayed surveillance at altitude. He'd got quickly familiarized with Little Lisbon's networks of alleys and transoms and back trash lots, and its dwindling population of feral cats and dogs. The area was fertile in overhead clocks of banks and churches dictating movements. He carried his Browning X-444 serrated in its shoulder holster, strapped inside his one sock just above the spats of the formal footwear he'd taken off the same A-formal A-fair LTD sidewalk display as the tux's coat. His lighter was in a fluorescent zip-upable slash pocket. Quality trash bags were plentiful in dumpsters, and land barges stopped at lights. The James Principles of the Gifford Lectures, its razored-out receptacle heart now quite a bit closer to empty than Lentz would be comfortable thinking about directly, he had in his hand tucked up under one formal arm. And the Chinese women scuttled, centipedishly abreast, their mammoth shopping bags held in a right hand and left, respective, so the bags were side by side between them. Lentz was closing the gap behind them, but gradually, and with no little nonchalant stealth, considering it was hard to walk stealthily when one couldn't feel one's feet and when one's eyeglasses darkened automatically whenever one went under a street light, and then took their time lightening up again after, so that no less than two of Lentz's vital sensory street senses were disoriented. But he still managed both, stealth and nonchalance both. He had no clue how he really looked. Like many of the itinerant mad of Metro Boston, he tended to confuse a wide berth with invisibility. The shopping bags looked heavy and impressive, their weight making the Chinese women lean in slightly toward each other. Call it 22:14 hours and 10 minutes. The Chinese women and then Lentz all passed a gray-faced woman squatting back between two dumpsters, her multiple skirts hiked up. Vehicles were packed bumper flush all along the curb, with myriad double parking also. The Chinese women passed a man lined up at the curb with a toy bow and arrows. and when the glasses undarkened, Lentz could see him as well as he passed also. The guy wore a rat-colored suit and was shooting a suction cup arrow at the side of a four-lease building and then going up and drawing a miniature chalk circle on the brick around the arrow and then another circle around that arrow and etc. As in a... what's the word? The woman paid him no orientoid mind. The suit string tie was also brown in tone, unlike a rat's tail. His wall's chalk was more pinkish. One of the women said something high-pitched, like an exclamation to the other. Your monkey language's exclamatories have an explosive ricocheting sound to them, as in a component of boing to every word. A window up across the street was producing the Star-Spangled Banner all this time. The man had a string tie and fingerless little gloves, and he stepped back from the wall to examine his pink circles and almost collided with Lentz, and they both looked at each other and shook their heads, like, look at this poor son of an urban bitch I'm on the same street with. It was universally well known that your basic orientoid types carried their earthly sum total of personal wealth with them at all times, as in, on their person, while they scuttled around. The orientoid religion prohibited banks, and Lentz had seen mammoth, double-width, twine-handled shopping bags and too many tiny Chinese women's hands not to have deducted that the Chinese female species of Oriental used shopping bags to carry their personal wealth. He felt the energy required for the snatch and sprint increasing now with each stride, drawing nonchalantly closer, able now to distinguish different patterns in the clear, like plastic flags they wrapped their little hair in, the Chinese women. His heart rate speeded to a steady, warming gallop. He began to feel his feet. Adrenaline about what would shortly occur dried his nose and helped his mouth stop moving around on his face. The frightful hog was not and never numb, and now it stirred in the snow pants slightly with excitement of wits and the thrill of the hunt. Far from cutting-edge surveillance, the shoe was on the other foot. The unwitting Oriental women had no idea who they were dealing with. Behind them. No idea he was back there surveilling them and closing the nonchalant gap, stumbling only slightly after each streetlight's light. He was in total control of this situation, and they did not even know there was a situation. Bullseye! Lance straightened the mustache with one finger and gave a tiny little yellow brick road stutter skip of pure controlling glee. His adrenaline, invisible, for all to see. There were two ways of going, and Les Assassins de Fauteuil Roulant were prepared to pursue both these. Less better was the indirect route, surveillance and infiltrating the surviving associates of the entertainment's auteur, its actress and rumored performer, relatives, if necessary, taking them, and subjecting them to technical interview, leading with hope to the original auteur's cartridge of the entertainment. This had risks and exposures and was held abeyant until the director route, to locate and secure a master copy of the entertainment on their own, had been exhausted. It was this way that thus, they were now still here, in the Antitoire shop of Cambridge, to, comme on dit, be turning all the stones. The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The secret to sprinting in high heels, poor Tony Kraus knew, was to run on one's toes, inclined way forward, with so much forward momentum that one stayed well up on her toes, and the heels never came into play. Evidently, the wretched creature behind him knew this trade secret too. They careered up Prospect, the creature's clutching hand just millimeters away from the trailing boa. Poor Tony held the two purses together, tucked away against his side like a football in U.S. football. Pedestrians moved artfully aside, long practiced. Poor Tony saw the pedestrians' faces very clearly as his odor preceded him like a shock wave. A man in a car coat made a smell face and did a kind of artful Veronica to let the two of them career past. Poor Tony's breath came in great, ragged, stitchy gasps. He had not banked on victim pursuit. He felt the creature's hand grope for purchase on the remains of his boa. The Donegal cap flew off and was not mourned. The thing's own breathing was also ragged, but the obscenity she hurled still came from the diaphragm, with conviction and vigor. The other thing had impacted a pole with a meaty sound Tony had shuddered to hear. His own father had struck himself about the head and shoulders as he grieved for his symbolically dead son. The moment after the impact and the strap gave way, Tony was up on his toes and in full flight, not banking on pursuit from the other one, this black creature screaming and just off his tail. For the first couple blocks, the creature had shouted for help and to stop the bitch, and poor Tony, then with a decent lead, had countered by also yelling, help, and for God's sake, stop her, flummoxing any would-be citizens. An ancient trade device among Harvard Square crews. But now the black creature had closed to within millimeters, and now it had real hold of the boa as they careered, breathing at full speed on their toes, and Kraus unlooped the thing from his neck with a flourish and sacrificed the boa to the thing. But the loathsome creature's hand came right back, clutching at the air just over his leather collar, its ragged breath in his ear, cursing him. Poor Tony grieved in mid-stride at the thought that the thing had doubtless just tossed the boa carelessly aside into the street or gutter. Their shoes' toes formed complex and variable rhythms on the pavement. Sometimes their footfalls were in sync, then they were not. The thing stayed agonizingly just behind. Bold print signs for fresh killed chicken and complete destruction flashed past. Antetois Entertainment was just over two long north-south blocks distant. Kraus and pursuer both J-ran through a gridlocked intersection. Poor Tony shouted, help and please. The hand and hissed breath just behind him was like one of those simply horrid dreams where something unimaginable is chasing you for kilometer after kilometer, and just before its talons close on the back of your collar, you wake up sitting bolt upright. Except this horrid creature's clutching hand just behind him scenario went on and on. Storefront and curb and leaping pedestrians all melting together at the periphery due right. Antetois Entertainment's discreet back door was accessible by a parking alley that cut west off Prospect just before Broadway and went west to intersect a smaller and dumpster-lined north-south alley, one of whose dumpsters, in which poor Tony had occasionally slept when out late and short of train fare, was within underhand toss distance of the Canadian Brothers' rear exit. Poor Tony, purses under arm and the other hand clamped tight to the wig, calculated that if he could get a reasonable lead on the creature, by the time they hit the smaller alley, the dumpsters would keep it from seeing just which, hopefully unlocked rear door, P.T., sought basic human kindly refuge behind. He feinted around a bodega's sidewalk fruit display and shot a quick look back, hoping the creature would crash itself ass over tea kettle into the stacked fruit. It did not. It was still right there, breathing. Its stutter step around two cardboard tiers of Cape cranberries was discouragingly deft. This thing had all too clearly chased persons before. Its breath had a ragged implacability about it. It was all too clearly in this for the long haul. It was no longer shouting stop or gutterish obscenities. Poor Tony's breaths felt flamish. It sounded as if he were weeping almost. He tried to shout help and could not. He hadn't the breath to spare. Black specks floated upward through his vision. Only certain of the street lamps worked. His heartbeat was zakung, zakung, zakung. Poor Tony hurtled a queerly placed cardboard display for something wheelchaired and heard the creature vaulted also and land lightly on its toes. Its uppers were not straps and could not dig like the fine Ogniers. Tony felt blood on his feet. The entrance to the parking alley west was between a tax preparer's and something else. It was right around here. Kraus squinted. The black specks were tiny rings with opaque centers and floated upward through his sight like balloons, lazily. Poor Tony was post-seizure, infirm, not to mention withdrawn. His breath came in stitches and half-sobs. He could barely stay on his toes. He had not consumed food since before the library's men's room stall, which was how many days? He scanned the blurred storefronts ripping past. An elderly person went down with a noise as the creature stiff-armed him. Somewhere a rape whistle blew. The tax repairers had the odd storefront announcement. On parle le portugais ici. Its hand's finger knocked the rim of Tony's leather collar with each footfall until it moved up, and poor Tony could feel its fingers in the hair of the chignon he held clamped to his head with a hand. Poor Tony's father used to come home to 412 Mount Auburn Street, Watertown, at the completion of a long day of caesareans, and sit in a chair in the darkening kitchen, scratching at his head where his mask's green strings had dug into the head. Its doubtlessly luridly long-nailed fingers were twining for purchase in his wig's hair when they hit the preparators and Tony cut a sharp right, breaking a heel on the pivot but gaining several steps toward a lead as the creature's momentum carried it past the alley's recessed mouth. Kraus whimpered raggedly and flew west, up on his bloody toes, hearing his breath off both alley walls, negotiating broken glass and the homeless supine. Hearing it back behind him several steps, crying a tight, echoed, "Stop! Motherfucking stop!" With a supine person, Kraus vaulted, lifting a decayed head from the alley floor to counter with, "Go!" Having traced, through the strenuous technical interview of the sartorially eccentric craniofacial pain specialist, whom they had traced through the regrettably fatal technical interview of the young burglar,
300,
whose electrical surge tolerance proved considerably lower than that of his room's computer's machinery, having traced their best chances at a copy to the hapless Antoine establishment, it had taken the AFR then several days to find it there, the real entertainment. AFR's USA sales leader, Fortier, the son of a Glen Allman glassblower, had allowed none of the mirrors to be broken or dismantled. In all other respects, the search had been methodical and thorough. It was a neat search, and also orderly, with time taken. Because the viewer of the shop was visually dysfunctional, a consumer teepee had been purchased and set up for volunteer viewing in the room of storage off the shop's back room. Each cartridge of the shop's exhaustive shelves was sampled by a volunteer, then discarded in one of the huge metal coffre de main in the alley outside the shop's rear door. A detail had been assigned to roll the extinguished Antoine brothers in construction plastic and place them in a room of storage off the back room. This was for hygienic purposes. A detail also had procured an oilskin window shade for the front door's glass. Also some printed signs which read closed, ropas, and relanche. No person had knocked at the door after the first hours, thus. Quickly, on the first day, in a liquor box which was damp and smelled, they had found an example of the rival FLQ's tactical street display cartridges with its crudely stamped smiling face and the "Il nous faut plus qu'on poursuive le bonheur" embossed upon it. And young Tassigny, with characteristic valor, volunteered to be rolled into the room of storage and strapped in order to verify this, and Fortier allowed this. Father drank the gesture of a toast to Tassigny, and promised to look after his aged father and fur traps. And Monsieur Fortier had embraced the young volunteer and kissed both his face's cheeks as he was rolled in and fitted by Monsieur Bourguim with EEG wires and strapped in before the viewer placed in the room of storage. Then the cartridge of the street display turned out to be blank, void. And then another from this box, also wet, also blank. Two blanks. Dunk, d'accord. Fortier, philosophical, counseled against disappointment or damage from a frustration. He and Marat had counseled all along that the FLQ displays of the entertainment and the wheelchaired man were probably the hoax, instilling of terror only. The fact that the displays which featured wheelchairs, a smack to the testicles of AFR, this was ignored. AFR wanted only to repossess this copy of the entertainment. As well, chiefly, now to determine, could this copy of Duplessis itself be copied? This was the real objective, a master cartridge.
301.
Unlike the FLQ, Les Assassins des Fauteuils Roulants had no interest in blackmail or cartographic extortings for the convexity's return. Not in reconfiguration of ONAN, or even its charter's dissolution. The AFR were interested only in dealing the sort of testicular frappe to the underbelly of USA self-interests that would render Canada itself unwilling to face the USA retaliation for this. If AFR could secure, copy, and disseminate the entertainment, Quebec would not be so much allowed as required by Ottawa to secede, to face on its own the wrath of a neighbor struck down by its own inability to say non to fatal pleasures.
302.
Fortier bid the AFR methodically to continue the search. Younger volunteers were rolled into the room of storage on a rotating basis to sample each set of cartridges. Aside from some bickering over the Portuguese pornography, the rotation proceeded with valor and care. The plastic-wrapped cadavers began to swell, but the plastic maintained hygienic conditions adequately for viewing samples of the many cartridges in the room of storage. The search and inventory proceeded in a painstaking and slow fashion. Monsieur Fortier was required to absent himself for a period, in the search's middle, to help facilitate Southwest Ops, the infiltration of that relative of the auteur felt most strongly, according to Marat, to have knowledge or possession of a duplicable copy. There was reason to think Monsieur Duplessis had received his original copies from this relative, an athlete. Marat felt USBSS felt this person may have borne responsibility for the razzles and dazzles of Berkeley and Boston, USA. The American's field operative, jutting with prostheses, had been clinging to this person like a bad odor. The nation USA treated wheelchaired persons with the solicitude that the weak substitute for respect, as if he were a sickly child, Fortier. Buses knelt, smooth ramps flanked steps. Attendants pushed him aboard flights in full, solicitous view of those standing upon legs. Fortier owned attachable legs of flesh-tone polymer resins, whose interior circuitry was responsive to large bundle neural stimuli from his stumps, which, with metal crutches, whose bracelets locked to his wrists, allowed a sort of swirling parody of perambulation. But Fortier, he rarely wore the prostheses, not in USA, and never for public transit. He preferred the condescension, the pretense of institutional sensitivity to his right of the equal access. It honed the edge of his senses of purpose. Like all of them, Fortier was willing to sacrifice. The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. After so long not caring, and then now the caring crashes back in and turns so easily into obsessive worry in sobriety. A few days before the debacle in which Don Gately got hurt, Joelle had begun to worry obsessively about her teeth. Smoking base cocaine eats teeth, corrodes teeth, attacks the enamel directly. Chandler Foss had explained all this to her at supper, showing her his corroded stumps. In her Latin cloth purse now, she carried a traveler's brush and expensive toothpaste, which alleged enamel revitalizers and anti-corrosives. Several of the in-house residents who'd hit bottom with the glass pipe had no teeth, or blackened and disintegrating teeth. The sight of Wade McDade's or Chandler Foss's teeth gave Joelle the fantods like nothing at meetings could. The toothpaste was only recently available over the counter and was a whole level of power and expense above standard smoker's polish. As she lies on her side beside Kate Gompert's empty bunk, her veils selvage tucked secure between pillow and jaw, and Charlotte Treat also asleep across the lit room, Joelle dreams that Don Gately, unhurt and Mid-South accented, is ministering to her teeth. He is bibbed in dental white, humming softly to himself, his big hands deft as he plucks instruments from the gleaming chairside tray. Her chair is dental and canted back, yielding her face up to him, her legs shut tight and stretching up and out before her. Dr. Don's eyes are abstractly kind, concerned for her teeth, and his thick fingers, as he inserts things to hold her open, are gloveless and taste warm and clean. Even the light seems sterilely clean. There is no assistant. The dentist is solo, leaning in above her, humming absent chords as he probes. His head is massive and vaguely square. In the dream, she is concerned for her teeth and feels Gately shares her concern. She feels good that he makes no chit-chat, and probably doesn't know her name. There's very little eye contact. He is completely intent on her teeth. He is there to help, if possible, is his whole demeanor's message. His bib hangs by a necklace of tiny steel balls and could not be whiter, his head haloed with a strap and a polished metal disc attached to the strap just above his eyes, a tiny mirror of stainless steel, clean as the instrument's tray. And the dream's yielding and trustful quality of calm is undercut only by the view of her face in the halo's mirror, the disc like a third eye in Gately's broad, clean forehead. Because she can see her face, convexly distorted and ravaged by years of cocaine and not caring, her face, all bug eyes and sunken cheeks, lamp black smudges beneath the Popeyes. And as the dentist's warm, thick fingers gently draw her lips back, she looks up into his head's mirror at long rows of all canine teeth, tapered and sharp, with then more rows of canines behind them in reserve. The countless rows of the teeth are all sharp and strong and unblackened, but tinged at the tips with an odd kind of red, as of old blood, the teeth of a creature that carelessly tears at meat. These are teeth that have been up to things she hasn't known about, she tries to say around the fingers. The dentist hums, probing. In the dream, Joelle looks up into Don Gately's forehead's dental mirror's disc and is seized with a fear of her teeth, a terror. And as her spread mouth spreads farther to cry out in fear, all she can see in the little round mirror are endless red-stained rows of teeth leading back and away down a pitch-black pipe. And the image of all these rows of teeth in the disc blots out the big dentist's good face as he probes with a hook and says he assures her that these can be saved. Then, by the time Fortier was able to return to the dismantled shop, they had located a third cartridge emblazoned with the embossed smile and letters disclaiming need of happy pursuit, and after some regretful losses, they had secured and verified it. The Zamizdat cartridge of entertainment, burglared from the death of Duplessis. Fortier was told the story. The cell's young Desjardins had been taking his turn in the viewing rotation, seated with young Tassigny in the room of storage during the hours of early morning, sampling the dregs of unshelved entertainments found in kitchen can waste bags in the same closet the Antetoile cadavers were swelling within. Desjardins had just moments before complained of the wasted time of cartridges scheduled for the Corfe demain. Tassigny, who had been in the room of storage with Desjardins, then was saved by the need to leave this room to change the bag of his partial colostomy. But, Marat reported, they had lost Desjardins, and the older and valued Joubé also, who rolled against orders into the room of storage to see why Desjardins had not been sending out the tapes for more tapes to sample. Both were lost. They had not lost more only because someone had thought to wake up Bruyme, whom Fortier had briefed with care on procedures for if the actual entertainment was found by this viewing. But two were lost. Joubé, the red-bearded workhorse, who loved pop wheelies, and young Desjardins, so filled with the idealism and so young as to be still feeling the phantom pains in his stumps. Rémy Marat reported that the two had been made comfortable since their loss, allowed to remain in the locked room of storage and view the entertainment again and again, silent behind the door except when the watch detail reported the hearing of cries of impatience at the player's rewinder to rewind. Marat reported they had declined to come out for water or food, or Joubé, who was diabetic, for his insulin. Monsieur Bruyme estimated that it would be a matter of hours now for Joubé, perhaps maybe one day or 2 days for Desjardins. Fortier had sadly said, "Buff," and acceptingly shrugged. All knew the sacrifices that might have been required. All viewing details had taken their chances at random in the rotation of viewing. On Fortier's return, Marat delivered also the expected bad news of the finding of it. There was no need yet for high RPM hardware of duplication. The found copy was read-only.
303.
Philosophical, Fortier reminded the AFR that they did now encouragingly know the entertainment of such power did truly exist for themselves and could thus gird their courage and fortitude for the more indirect task of forfeiting hopes of securing a master copy and instead striving to secure the original master, the auteur's own cartridge, from which all read-only copies had presumably been copied. Thus, he said, now the more arduous and risky task of taking for technical interview known persons associated with the entertainment and locating the original maker's duplicable master copy. None of this would have been worthy of the risk had they not now determined, through the heroic sacrifices of Joubert and Desjardins, that the device for extending ONAN's self-destructing logic to its final conclusion lay within their arduous grasp. Fortier gave numerous orders. The platoon of AFR remained in the closed Antetois entertainment shop, behind their lingual window shade. Surveillance on the hated FLQ's Bureau Central, in the poorly disciplined house on Alston's Rue de Brenner, this was suspended. The AFR personnel pulled in and relocated to this commandeered Inman Square shop, where Fortier and Marat and Monsieur Bruyme coordinated phases of activity in this next more arduous and indirect phase, and reviewed tactics also. The deceased auteur's colleagues and relations were under constant surveillance. Their concentration of place worked in the favor of this. An employee at the Academy of Tennis of Enfield had been recruited and joined the Canadian instructor and student already inside for closer work of surveillance. In the desert, the redoubtable Mademoiselle Luria P. was winning necessary confidences with her usual alacrity. An expensive source in the subject's former department of the MIT University had reported the entertainment's probable performer's last known employment, the small Cambridge radio station which Marat and Beausoleil had pronounced oui, where she had donned the defacing veil of ONANite deformity. Attentions were to be focused on the cartridge's performer and on the Academy of Tennis of the auteur's estate. The fact that the players of the Academy were to play a provincially selected team from Quebec would have been easier to exploit had the AFR possessed a tennis player of talent and lower extremities. Inquiries into the composition and travel of the Quebecois team were underway from sources at home in Papineau. On the day of Fortier's return also, the performer's radio program's technical engineer of radio had been acquired in a public but low-risk operation, whose success had raised hopeful spirits for the acquisitions of more directly related persons to the entertainment in this next phase. This person of USA Radio had divulged all he professed to know under the mere descriptive threat of technical interview procedures. Marat, the best lay judge of Americans' veracity, which the cell possessed, believed the veracity of the engineer, but nevertheless a formal technical interview had proceeded, justified in order to verify. The young and eruption-studded person's report remained consistent 2 levels past average USA endurance, the only variance involving several curious claims that the Massachusetts Institute of Technology was defensive in bed. Today, Fortier himself and Marat, young Balbulus, R. Osevecki, all those with the better English, were thus now therefore making the rounds of all substance difficulty rehabilitation facilities in hospitals, psychiatric institutions, and demi-maison within a 25-kilometer radius. Procedures for expanding the radius of inquiry by factors of 2 and 3 had been pre-formulated, teams assembled, lines rehearsed. Joubert and then Desjardins had succumbed and been transported north by van as well with the remains of the Antetois remains. The USA student radio engineering person, the veracity of whose limited statements of the subject's whereabouts Brahim had verified to within plus or minus 0.35 of assurance well before debriefing levels incompatible with physical existence, had been allowed several hours to recover, then had become of service as the AFR's first subject in field tests of the Samizdat cartridge's motivational range. The room of storage again was utilized for this. They sat immobilized with some straps. The test subject had viewed the entertainment twice at gratis, without the application of any motivational inquiry. For inquiry into the degree of motivation the cartridge will induce, Monsieur Brahim had rolled himself blindfolded into the room of storage, holding an orthopedic saw, and informed the subject of the test that, as of beginning now, each subsequent reviewing of the entertainment now would have the price of one digit from the subject's extremities. And handed the subject the orthopedic saw in question also. Brahim's explanation to Fortier was that thus a matrix could be created to compute the statistical relation between N, the number of times the subject replayed the entertainment, and T, the amount of time he took to decide and remove a digit for each subsequent N plus one viewing. The goal was to confirm with statistical assurance the subject's desire for viewing and reviewing as incapable of satiation. There could be no index of diminishing satisfaction, as in the econometrics of normal USA commodities. For the Samizdat Entertainment's allure to be macro-politically lethal, the ninth digit of extremities had to come off as quickly and willingly as the second. Brahim, personally, he had some skepticism about this, but this was Brahim's function in his role in the cell. Expertise in combination with skepticism to Kerr. And then, naturally, also a wider range of field test subjects would then be required to verify that this subject's responses were not merely subjective and typical only of a certain sensibility of entertainment consumer. The bus window yielded a faint and ghostly reflection of Fortier, and through that faint view, the lights of urban life outside the bus. Somerville, Massachusetts, USA's Phoenix House administrative person, had listened to Fortier's delivery with shows of great compassion, then explained with patience that they were unable to admit addicted persons for whom English was the secondary language. D'accord, though he was pretending disappointment. Fortier had been able to see the admitted addicts of Phoenix House holding a gathering in the room of living outside the office door. No person among them wore a veil of facial concealment. And so, Sissa. Four small teams were at this moment rolling through the streets and small streets and alleys of the unpleasant district of the Antitois establishment for the purpose of acquiring additional subjects for Monsieur Brahim for the time when the subject's digits were expended. The subjects for suitability had to be passively undefended enough to be acquired publicly with quiet, yet not damaged in the brains or under the influence of the many of the district's intoxicant compounds. The AFR were highly trained in patience and to be disciplined. The southbound bus, empty, and, which he detested, fluorescently lit, climbs a thin hill off Winter Park, North Cambridge, heading for the squares Inman and Central. Fortier looks out at the lights passing. He can smell snow coming. It soon will snow. He sees in his imagination two-thirds of NNE's largest urban city inert, sybaratically entranced, staring, without bodily movement, home-bounded, fouling their divans and the chairs which may recline. He sees the district of businesses' towers of buildings and luxury apartments, striated as two of every three floors is darkened to lightless black, with here and there the vaguely blue flicker of expensive digital entertainment equipment flickering through darkened windows. He imagines Monsieur Tyne holding the hand, holding the pen, of President J. Gentle as the ONANite president signs declaring war. He imagines teacups clinking thinly beneath trembling hands in the interior sanctums of Ottawa's sanctum of power. He adjusts his sport coat's lapel over his sweater and smooths the wiry hair that tends to bulge unsmoothly around the bare spot. He watches the back of the bus driver's neck as the driver stares straight ahead. Sure enough, the Chinquette women had been strengthless and lightweight, flew aside like dolls, and their bags were indeed treasure-heavy, hard to heft. But as Lance cut left down the north-south alley, he could hold the bags by their twine handles out slightly before him, so their weight's momentum kind of pulled him along. The cruciform alleys through the blocks between Central and Inman, in Little Lisbon, were a kind of second city. Lance ran. His breath came easy, and he could feel himself from scalp to sole. Green, and green with red dumpsters lined both walls and made the going narrow. He vaulted two sitting figures in khaki, sharing a can of Sterno on the alley floor. He glided through the foul air above them, untouched by it. The sounds behind him were his footfalls echo off dumpsters and fire escapes iron. His left hand ached nicely from holding both a bag's handle and his large print volume. A dumpster up ahead had been hitched to an EWD truck and just left to sit, probably quitting time. The Empire guys had an incredible union. In the recess of the hitch's bar, a small blue light flickered and died. This was a dozen dumpsters up ahead. Lentz slowed to a brisk walk. His topcoat had slipped slightly off one of his shoulders, but he had no free hand to fix it and wasn't going to take time to put a bag down. His left hand felt cramped. It was somewhere vague between 22:24 and 22:26 hours. The alley was dark as a pocket. A tiny crash off somewhere south down the network of alleys was actually poor Tony Krause rolling the steel waste barrel that tripped up Ruth Van Cleve. The tiny blue flame came on, hung still, flickered, moved, hung there, went back out. Its glow was dark blue against the back of the huge EWD truck. Empire trucks were unstrippable. Hitches were valuable, but locked down with a kryptonite device thing, you needed welding stuff to cut through. From the recess of the hitch, there were small sounds. When the lighter lit again, Lance was almost on them. Two boys on the hitch, and two squatting down by the hitch facing them. Four of them. A fire escape's pull ladder distended like a tongue and hanging just above them. None of the boys was over, like, 12. They used an M fizzy bottle instead of a pipe, and the smell of burnt plastic hung mixed with the sick, sweet smell of overcarbonated rock. The boys were all small and slight, and either black or spick, greedily hunching over the flame. They looked ratty. Lance kept them in peripheral view as he strode briskly by, carrying his bags, spine straight and extruding dignified purpose. The lighter went out. The boys on the hitch eyed Lance's bags. The squatting boys turned their heads to look. Lance kept them in peripheral view. None of them wore watches. One of them wore a knit cap and watched steadily. He locked eyes with Lance's left eye, made a gun of his thin hand, pretended to draw a slow bead, like performing for the others. Lance walked by with urban dignity, like he both saw them and didn't. The smell was intense, but real local, of the rock and bottle. He had to veer out to miss the Empire truck's side mirror on its steel strut. He heard them say things as the truck's grill fell behind, an unkind laughter, and then something called out in a minority agnate he didn't know. He heard the lighter's flint. He thought to himself, assholes. He was looking for someplace empty and a bit more lit to go through the bags, and cleaner than this one north-south alley here, which smelled of ripe waste and rotting skin. He would separate the bag's valuables from the non-valuables and transfer the valuables to a single bag. He would fence the non-negotiable valuables in Little Lisbon and refill the receptacle in his medical dictionary and buy some attractiver shoes. The alley was devoid of cats and rodents both. He did not stop to reflect why. A rock or bit of brick, courtesy of the junior crack jockeys back there, landed behind him and skittered past and rang out against something, and someone cried out aloud. A sexless figure lying back against a maybe duffel bag or pack against a dumpster, its hand moving furiously in its groin, and its feet pointed out into the alley and turned out like a dead body's. Its shoes, two different shoes, its hair a clotted mass around its face, looking up over at Lentz going past in the faint start of light from a broader alley's intersection ahead. Chanting softly what Lentz could hear as he stepped gingerly over the rot-smelling legs as,
"Pretty, pretty, pretty."
Lentz whispered to himself, "Jesus, what a lot of fucked up ass-eating fucking losers." Our cult burned money for fuel. As in like currency. We used ones. The semi-divine one advocated thrift. We'd bring them to him at the stove. There was one stove. We had to bring them to him on our knees with no part of our feet could touch the floor. He sat by the stove in our blankets and fed it ones. We got an extra slap if the currency was new. As in like crisp new.
It was a cleansing. Somebody always played a drum.
Our cult's divinely chosen leader drove a Rolls, in neutral. We pushed him wherever he was called to, like, be at. He never turned it on. The Rolls. I got all muscled up. In summer then, they made us slither on our bellies. We had to embrace our snake nature. It was a cleansing.
As in like slithering.
Serious slithering. They took wire and bound our arms and legs.
At least your wire wasn't barbed.
I finally felt too cleansed to stay.
Meaning overpure. I can ID, totally.
It was too much love somehow to take.
I'm like feeling the identification all over. This is...
Plus I was up to 3 bags a day at the end. And then our divinely chosen's love squads made us chop wood with our teeth when it got cold. As in like sub-zero wintertime.
Yours let you keep your teeth?
Only the ones for gnawing, see?
Sheesh.
Just the ones for gnawing. Rami Marat sat veiled and blanket-lapped in the much-crowded living room evening of this Ennett House drug and alcohol recovery house, the last demi-maison on his portion of the list for this day. The hills of Upper Enfield, they were de l'enfer of difficulty, but the demi-maison itself had a ramp. A person with authority was conducting interviews to fill some vacancies of recent time in the place's office, of which its locked door was visible from this sitting. Marat and others were invited to sit in the living room with a cup of unpleasant coffee. Urged to smoke if he liked. Everyone else was smoking. The living room smelled like an ashtray, and its ceiling was yellow like the fingers of long smokers. Also, the living room evening resembled an anthill which had been stirred with a stick. It was too full of persons, all of them restless and loud. There were demi-maison patients viewing a cartridge of martial arts conflict, former patients and persons of the Upper Enfield area cohabiting on the furniture, conversing. A damaged woman, also in a fauteuil de roulant, like Marat, slumped in util next to the cartridge's viewer, while a male person of advanced pallor mimed the kicks and thrusts of martial arts at her motionless head, trying to force the woman to twitch or cry out. Also, a man without hands and feet trying to negotiate the stairway. Other persons, presumably addicted, waiting in the room to seek admittance to the recovery house. The room was loud and hot. Marat could hear a person who will seek admittance vomiting in the shrubberies just outside the window. Marat's chair was locked down next to a divan's arm and directly before a window. The window, one could wish it was open more than a crack, he felt. Upon the dull-colored carpet, a tormented-appearing man scuttling like the crab while two hooligans, in leather, played a cruel game of jumping over him. Persons reading cartoon books and painting the nails of their extremities. A tall-haired woman brought her foot to her mouth to blow upon her toes. Another young girl seemed to remove her eye from her head and place it in her mouth. No other in the room wore the veil of the Entertainment Performers Organization, UHID. The smell of the USA cigarettes permeated his veil and made Marat's eyes water, and he thought of vomiting also. Two additional windows were open, but the room lacked all air. During the time of his sitting, several persons approached Marat, but they would say to him only the whispers,
"Pet the dogs,"
or
"Make sure and pet the dogs."
This idiomatic expression was not in Marat's knowledge of USA idiom. Also, one person approached of a face whose skin seemed that it was rotting away from him in some way,
and asked him if he, Murat, was court-ordered. Murat was one of few persons not smoking. He noted that none of the room's persons appeared to regard the cheesecloth veil he wore over his face as